Leading Ideas Talks is brought to you by the Lewis Center for Church Leadership of Wesley Theological Seminary in Washington, D.C. Subscribe free to our weekly newsletter at www.churchleadership.com/leading ideas. Leading Ideas Talks has been brought to you by Taking Church to the Community. This video toolkit explores strategies your congregation can use to reach beyond its walls with worship, community events, ministries, and service. How can we live into a more multi-ethnic vision for our congregations? In this episode, we speak with Reverend Dr. Jackie Lewis of Middle Collegiate Church about multicultural and multiracial congregations, plus the joys and challenges of being a multi-ethnic congregation.
Welcome to Leading Ideas Talks, a podcast featuring thought leaders and innovative practitioners. I'm Douglas Poe, the director of the Lewis Center, and your host for this talk. Joining me is Reverend Dr. Jackie Lewis, the pastor of Middle Collegiate Church. Our focus for this podcast is leading multiracial and multicultural congregations. Jackie, I'm so happy you could join us today. I look forward to this conversation. And I want to begin by asking you, how would you distinguish between multiracial and multicultural? I know some people think they're the same thing, others think they're different. I'm curious of what's your opinion in using this language.
Thank you. First of all, thank you so much for the opportunity to chat with you today about this. I think it's ironic that right now my staff is going through an anti-racist training. We're reading White Fragility and had a trainer come in yesterday to help us talk about it. And I think the truth is that there's really only one race, and that race is human. And so almost every time we're talking about the difference between culture groups, those who are physiologically different, we're not talking about race, actually. We're talking about ethnicity. So we try to use multiracial, though, because the nation still hasn't caught up to that definition. So when I think about what a multiracial congregation is, it's a congregation with more than one ethnicity.
So in that sense, then, congregations could be multi-ethnic and at the same time have different cultures, or congregations could be multicultural but not necessarily multi-ethnic.
Exactly. That's exactly right. Doesn't that make sense? So, for example, you think way back to Worship Wars, written by Tom Long. Yeah. You could be in, let's say, an all-white-seeming church, right? Inside that white-seeming church, there are many cultures. There might be Lutheran white folks who worship a certain way, or there could be older white people who have different expectations about worship, or there could be an LGBTQ culture right inside the white church. So many cultures in one church. And in multi-ethnic church might feel more monocultural. It might be. Right. Say, for example, you're in a multiracial, multi-ethnic church where all the people are from the D.C. Beltway and all of the people are work in government, or, you know, all the people make a certain income. You'd have less many cultures, but you have more ethnicities.
If you think about congregations and economic difference, or economic similarities, I should say, you could have rich people from various ethnicities together. Would you say then that they have a shared culture because of economics in that sense that could be a driving force?
I think that's right. And what we'd analyze is inside that congregation, one of the cultures, because I want to argue every church is multicultural, but one of the cultures would be class.
Right.
Yeah. In that sense, we have a shared culture because we all are high earners. And let's say even we have a shared culture because we're all Republican and high wage earners.
Right.
Okay. So those are some ways that you can have some similar culture or same culture, even in the midst of diversity.
Yeah.
Does that make sense?
It makes a lot of sense. And you talk about diversity, and that actually leads into my next question. A lot of congregations talk a lot about diversity. And always are saying, we want more diversity. What are some things that leaders and congregations can do to actually increase their diversity? And I'm really thinking of established congregations, because I think once you're established and been established for a while, it seems like it's harder and harder to become more diverse.
Yeah, that is an excellent question. I mean, I think one of the first things a congregation needs to do to increase its diversity, besides buying our book.
I like
my
it.
My husband and I have a book called The Pentecost Paradigm, 10 Strategies to Build a Multiracial, Multicultural Church. But I think appreciative inquiry would be a strategy. Yes. Like, we could say to ourselves, we already know how to do diversity. Look at the diversity here. And to be really intentional about noticing, celebrating, affirming the diversity that's there. We have generational diversity. We have worship style diversity. We've got single parents and we've got families. We've got LGBTQ community and we've got straight. So you start by naming and owning the diversity you have there and ask yourself, how are we doing this? What are the tactics we're using to make this place a safe place and a brave place for the diversity already in our midst? And what can we learn from that when we think about then pushing our diversity out? And if what one really means is, how do I make a multi-ethnic church? Then you have to start asking yourself, what am I willing to give up so people feel welcome? And that gets to your point about established places. You know, you can't just say, we're going to be more diverse. You got to, like, shift the way you be in order to invite others in. Worship style, who leads, who's sitting on the pulpit, what kinds of songs do we sing, what kind of music do we do, what kind of instruments do we do, how can we use art to help more folks find their way in more portals for people to come in. So there's some first thoughts.
So if, and I agree with you that a lot is, you have to be willing to give something up or be willing to change something. Mm-hmm. So congregations that are obviously struggling and declining in a neighborhood that represents a great diversity, why do you think they're so unwilling to make those changes?
I think they're afraid. I think our identities are so tied to our sense of kind of self and self-esteem. You know, we are these people. We are, you know, white, we grew up in this neighborhood, this is our history, this is our culture. And the changing demographics of the world have the world on fire, right?
Uh-huh.
The whole world, every white entrenched nation is afraid of demographic shifts and immigration patterns and migrants moving into the world. So it's a fear of loss of power, a loss of identity, a loss of status quo. And what the consequence of that fear is death. And so, you know, not to be strident, but to say, do you want to live?
Right.
Do we want to live? And if so, we have to prepare ourselves for a new multiracial, multi-ethnic future.
Yeah, I agreed. So staying in that sort of line, as we think about sermons, and of course, you're fortunate enough to have a congregation that's multi-ethnic, and multicultural, but for someone who is seeking to move in that direction, how do they prepare sermons that can actually speak to a diverse audience? I mean, because again, that can become challenging. Your illustrations, the way you think about things, again, probably needs to shift. So how do you help people to make that shift?
Well, that's an excellent question. You know, I think I would say every clergy in America today who hasn't put themselves in a study group, in a lectionary group, in a multiracial group of people talking, needs to put themselves in such a group if they want to be preaching for the 21st century. So can I be in a conversation with a Latinx pastor and a, you know, African-American pastor, maybe a Korean pastor in my neighborhood, so that as I begin to exegete the text to prepare for preaching, I'm not only looking at the Bible itself and its historic context, right? But I'm also exegeting the world today. And the best way to do that is in conversation with other partners who are different than you. Like, how does a Korean sense of Han, suffering, struggle, pathos, help me to think about, let's say, an African-American sense of hope? And a European sense, and let's be particular, maybe maybe an Irish sense of what it means to be the other, you know? If we can be in conversation with people who are different than we are as we're preaching, I think that helps us write a sermon that is multi-ethnic. And the conversation partners are ideally live, but also, what commentaries are we reading? You know, are we reading Dolores Williams and Katie Cannon? Are we reading James Cone? Are we reading womanist articles like Ebony Marshall Turman? I mean, are we putting ourselves in conversation also with research that is more than just white Western?
So in your own work, how long does it take you to do this? Because I can imagine that a lot of individuals hear what you're saying, but will say, that sounds like a tremendous investment to preach for 20, 25 minutes on Sunday.
Yeah, it is. It's an hour per minute, right? Isn't that what our professors told us?
That's right.
And I don't think it has to be an hour per minute all in one day. That's probably actually not your best sermon.
Yeah, I think that's helpful. I want to shift a little bit, and I'm going to go to one of your older books. In your book, The Power of Stories, you share that we are all formed by stories, and I think that you're absolutely correct. My question, though, if my story is the only one I know, it's the one I grew up with, it's the one that has shaped and formed me, then how do I expand my story?
Well, that's a great question. That's a great question. I think my first response might be therapy or spiritual direction. You know, we are formed in the stories that are told to us about us by our parents, by the media, right, by the world, history. Somebody wrote that, not necessarily us. But I think it's our responsibility as adults to be always thinking, how do I have a narrative, a story that is cohesive, that is coherent, that is life-giving? And we can change our stories, meaning until we die, we're writing a story about ourselves. So let's just say a girl child is molested by an adult in her life. That is a catastrophic event in a story. And she could stay victimized by that story. On the other hand, with research and writing and journaling and a therapist, she finds herself feeling resilient and like a badass, you know, like a powerful person because she survived that and the ways that she's led other people to survival. So I think stories have a beginning and a middle and an end, and our story isn't over till we die. Therefore, we get to be in the business of rewriting and making sense of and making meaning of our story all the way over our lifetime. And therapy, spiritual direction. One of my friends says a good friend is just as good as a good therapist. But to be purposeful, to be intentional about how we want to think of ourselves and how we want others to perceive us in ways that are true.
So what if I want to... My perception of myself negates who you are, and I'm okay with that. So how do we help others to see that while certainly I have a right to write my own story, but there's still a shared story when you're in communities with other people, that we have to be able to navigate that shared story?
Yep, I think that's a really important point that you're making. And so stories don't just shape, I think I say in the book, stories don't just shape individual identity. Right. They shape a shared narrative.
That's right. Right?
And that's what congregational life is.
Yes.
Congregational life, finding our shared narrative in the story of God at work in the world, right?
Yeah.
So we are, all of us, being impacted by, if I can stay in that story trope for a minute, being impacted by, having our narratives reshaped by the narratives of others. And that's why we have conflict, quite frankly. Because
my
story and your story don't sit well together. We have conflict. But if we embrace conflict as a healthy part of life, I get to be changed when I'm having a conflict with you. Not you, but you know, like, what really, is that how you think? Well, this is how I think. So that's about conversation. That's about care. That might even be about confrontation. But I want to say if our larger identity, our larger story, is the story of the holy at work in the world, if we make that our supra-identity, I think that gives us all a chance to lean into a story of hope and redemption and healing, restoration and reconciliation.
I think that's powerful. I think you can comment as the tricky piece is helping people really to think about focusing on the holy one in terms of the one who sort of directs our stories ultimately, that oftentimes we get caught up sort of in thinking we are the ones who sort of ultimately write our own narratives. I mean, do you think that's fair or unfair?
Oh, I think that's totally fair. And I think, you know, did you ever read Jim Loder, The Transforming Moment?
Yes.
Jim Loder,
yes. Right?
I love that. And I'm fascinated that his book about kind of being in search for a story that has an ending mirrors the work of Eugene Lowry in the homiletical plot.
Right, yeah.
And I want to put that on the table right now to say, maybe as faith leaders, one of our responsibilities is to help people to think, here's a story that is a universe, you know, it is the beginning of the universe and the end of the universe being held in the container that is God's love and God's intention for humanity. For me, as a busy, pathos-laden, frustrated with the world Black woman, I am find comfort feeling like God's holding us. And I don't think God's story for us is a linear, never-to-be-changed story either, just to be honest. But if I think I'm in community with other human beings who are in community with the Holy One, perfecting the universe, right? Healing the universe is the end of our story, the telos of our story.
Right.
That's liberating,
yeah,
and empowering. And I think if preachers could get clear that that's our aim, is to help our congregants, no matter who they look, no matter how they look, no matter who they love, no matter how they are, to cast themselves in the God story. Wouldn't that just be really, like, that's what I say to preachers when I'm teaching preaching. Our job is to help people find their way into that story and see themselves as agents and actors and powerful people inside that story, able to partner with God.
Yeah, no, that is definitely powerful. And just another follow-up to that, I'm going to try to bring it down a little bit more practical.
Yeah.
So how do you then sort of help people to act it out practically? So in your congregation, when you're dealing with different ethnicities or different cultures and conflicts mm-hmm. come up, how do you help them to practically remember we're part of this bigger story? What are some sort of things that individuals can think about in their own congregations to move in that direction?
Good. Let me start with the corporate, if you will. Those of us who preach, whether once a year or every Sunday, gosh, we have this holy, amazing responsibility to do this storying. Let's make that a verb, the storying for people. And each of us is always preaching through our own story. We have to own that. But the kind of, like, let's just say this year at Middle Church, the subtext of our preaching is Love Transforms. That's the theme we've picked this year. We're looking at the lectionary through Love Transforms. We're doing Bible study through Love Transforms. We're preaching through Love Transforms. So all of the people, the 350 people in that one, the 150 people in that worship, everybody online that's watching, are all having a shared text through the lens of Love Transforms. That's part one. So what? And there's always a so what. If Love Transforms, you've got a brokenhearted friend, bring them to church. You know, if Love Transforms, teach your child the power of standing up for the vulnerable even now. Since Love Transforms, our little people are staying in worship so they can overhear us. I'll tell you a particular story. Yesterday, we were preaching, my colleague and I did a duet, and we were preaching about the baptism of Jesus. And let's say our core message was, Jesus was already a child of God. baptism didn't make Jesus a Jew.
That's right. That's right.
So he was this like symbol, this sign, and baptism is an ongoing process of becoming the people of God and helping other people become the people of God. That was point two. And so at the very end of the sermon, I'm saying, do you know why we give each other a kiss during the passing of the peace? I say, in a way, that's a baptism. The early church ordained leaders by kind of doing a kiss of peace, which is about blowing God's love on each other. But before I answer that question, a little eight-year-old girl, when I said, do you know why we give each other a kiss? She raised her hand like she was in Sunday school. And I was like, come over here and tell me. 8 years old, Josie. Yeah. We kiss because we love each other. I said, that's right. We're loving each other into the people of God. And though she was heavy, I picked her up and put her on my hip. And I said, every kiss that we share is a baptism into the love of God. And that little girl kissed me on my lips, and I thought I was going to lose it. I almost dropped her. She got that. Right. An eight-year-old got that. So an eight-year-old white girl, let me say, got that. So the preaching project, the worship project, to have our children, our seniors, all of us kind of overhear and take deeply in how much we're a part of the story is one thing. I think the second thing is in multi-everything context, inevitably there's strife. And we have to, as leaders, not be afraid to take it on, to call somebody out. That's not the loving thing. That's not what that looks like. That's not the story that God's writing for us. And though you are welcome just as you are as you come through the door, when you get in here, there are norms and values of what it means to be a human. So we're at conflict with one of our old Jewish guys. We got old Jewish guys at the church. And he's in conflict with us, not because he's old and Jewish, but because he's behaving badly. And it's my responsibility as a leader who leads with love to even still say, uh-uh, baby, that is not how we do it, to take it on, to keep the whole community safe. Yeah. So that's two things. Public proclamation, consistently, this is the story of God, and this is how we fit in it. And privately, or sometimes in small groups, saying, when we're not acting loving, we don't get to be here in the community.
Yeah, that's helpful. I want to, I know you like Howard Thurman from reading. Yeah. And in the Power Stories, again, you talk about Howard Thurman and his use of imagination. And that Thurman could imagine a different society based on his grandmother's love of God, even though what he experienced was different. And I think imagination is powerful for leadership, because when we can help people to imagine something different, it then helps us to take a journey towards that which is different. How That's can right. we help more people to sort of engender that type of imagination, even though their experiences may be different?
That's such a good question. That's such a great question. It's like, it's an act of liberation or an act of play. Maybe I want to say something about both. And I'll do liberation first. You know, that story of Howard Thurman and how the church didn't want to do his dad's funeral because he wasn't really in the church, but how his grandmother just held out for him a picture of a preferred reality. Like, she was this vision caster, right?
Yes.
And I think if we teach our young people and remind our old people, kind of in that Joel scripture way, you know, we'll dream dreams, we'll see visions. It's liberating to think, though the world that we live in isn't how we want it to be, we can dream a world. You know that poem, I Dream a World?
Yes.
We can dream a world. And if we dream it, if we see it, we can do it together. Without it, without a vision, people perish. So I think it's liberating to use education, to use our sermons, to use our mentoring, to say, what are you dreaming about? What are you dreaming about? And how is your dream located in God's dream? And I think that's both our personal dreams and our dream for the world. It's liberating. It's a gift. It's a liberating gift. And how do we do it? We have to be intentional. We have to use language, use dream language, use vision language. Every year we have a congregation meeting. We just are asking people to tell us what they're dreaming about. My staff does one-on-ones with people, and the question we're always asking is, what are you dreaming about? What are you dreaming about? I don't have to remind my staff to ask that question anymore. It's just a part of who we are. And we try to take those dreams and play them back out. Some of you are dreaming that we'll, whatever, start a school.
That's,
you know,
right.
So like that. That's deliberating. I think the other thing, there's a really beautiful book called by Donald Winnicott called Playing in Reality. And that's in my Power Stories book.
Yeah.
I was deeply impacted by his writing when I was in a PhD program. But he's like, everything in life is play. And as a psychologist of religion, I think he's helped me to think that the life of worship is to rehearse God's reign. So let's turn that into some playful language. You know, how do we play together about that? How do we rehearse like that? So our children serve communion. When you walk up to a little kid and bend down and take communion from that kid, that's like playing in the reality that we hope for.
Right. It gives you a different picture of the kingdom.
Yes, yes. Exactly. The little kid lead us.
As we come sort of to the end, having you sort of dream a little bit, in 5 or 10 years, how will mainline congregations in your mind differ from today? Do you think they actually will become more multi-ethnic, or will we just sort of continue down this path we are currently, where you find a few places here or there where you have truly multi-ethnic congregations?
Yeah. I'm dreaming of a world where, I mean, this is 2020 almost, scary. But I'm dreaming of a world in 10 years, I'll do 10, so we have a little more time to get to my dream, where congregations have recognized the joy and beauty of being with the so-called other, that we actually, if we really believe we're created in the image of God, then we really don't know as much about God in a segregated space as we do in a multiracial, multi-ethnic, multicultural place. We learn texture, we learn vulnerability, we learn joy, we learn, you know, how to navigate problems. We learn about the holy, rubbing shoulders with someone who's not like us in the most profound way. So I'm dreaming that in 10 years, there has been a movement for multiracial, multicultural congregations that is blooming. And it isn't for like survival, you know, but it's for joy.
Yeah.
Like, wow. And that's because people kind of come to our conference in April and catch a vision, or the people who are doing this, the other churches that are doing this around the country, are showing it in the social, you know, world, in the eco space that is social media. Do you see this? See what this looks like? This is beautiful. We were on CBS on Christmas Eve instead of Stephen Colbert. And some of the notes we've gotten back from people are like, is that really how your church looks, or did you cast it? Like, no, that's really how it looks. I think that we yearn for a healed world. I think we want there to be an end of racism and discrimination. So more multiracial congregations flourishing out of joy, not survival, because we've seen it can happen, enough of us, and we're learning how to do it. And quite frankly, I'm dreaming of universalist spaces. I'm a Christian, like I follow Jesus. But Jesus was a Jew, and I can only imagine a God, like I only can believe in God, who speaks more than one language, who is speaking to Jews and Muslims and Buddhists, to humanists and Unitarians, in the language that they need to hear. That's in that book, Power Stories, like multivocal God. So I'm dreaming of more spaces where the worship is multiracial and multicultural and interfaith. I'd love to be the pastor of a giant multi-faith church.
That would be
where I share space with a rabbi and an imam and a sensei, and we're all taking turns preaching and, you know, leading the world toward love. Yeah.
Yeah.
Those are my dreams.
Well, it is a powerful dream, and I really appreciate your taking the time to be with us today. This has been wonderful.
How can congregations imaginatively use their space? In this episode, we speak with Bob Yeager, president of Partners for Sacred Places, about reimagining the space in your church building.
for an older historic church, yes, you're right, there can be that assumption that, you know, we've been here for 50 or 100 or 150 years, so certainly people must appreciate our importance to the community. And indeed, if we need some help to take care of this place, surely they will respond. And that is often a false assumption. And so I think what we do is to try to help congregations test those assumptions and really just get out there and talk to their neighbors and get a fresh new idea on how they're viewed and invite the community in.
Thank you for joining us. And don't forget to subscribe free to Leading Ideas at churchleadership.com/leadingideas.